We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Today's show, all about theater. After the calendar of events, I interview Stefan Haves and Phil Giffen, who are putting on a show called Shambles at the Ivy Substation in Culver City. More about that later. And then I interview Michelle Danner, director and acting teacher who has a studio also in Culver City. Here's the calendar. The hit Star Wars burlesque parody, The Empire Strips Back, playing in Los Angeles now through January, this previously sold-out experience drops classic sci-fi characters into the world of burlesque. EmpireStripsBack.com for more information. It's at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. The Actors Gang bids adieu to 2022 in Shambles, the Cirque-infused immersive holiday extravaganza. Tickets at theactorsgang.com. This starts December 8th, 12 performances only, at the Ivy Substation in Culver City, Q Theater. At the Wallace, through December 18th, Romeo and Juliet, reimagined through the music of Pat Benatar. TheWallace.org for more information. Go to BroadwayInHollywood.com if you want to find out about musical theater in Los Angeles at the fabulous Dolby and Pantages Theaters. They're featuring Annie, The Sun Will Come Out through December 18th, The Book of Mormon through December 11th, Jesus Christ Superstar at the end of the month, and also Harry Connick Jr. and Lindsey Stirling around the holidays. Again, BroadwayInHollywood.com for more information. And lastly, the LA Phil's 2022 Deck the Hall Holiday Concert Series, featuring The Nutcracker with Dudamel. That'll be on December 14th and 18th. Symphonies for Youth. Dudamel conducts The Nutcracker December 10th and 17th. A Chanticleer Christmas. That's December 13th. Home Alone in Concert, December 20th through the 22nd. Arturo Sandoval, Swinging Holiday, December 23rd. And New Year's Eve with the Roots, that will be December 31st. LAPhil.com for more information. This series features star-studded vocalists, blockbuster movie screenings performed with orchestra, notable conductors, and family-friendly fun, all in celebration of the winter holiday season. Once again, LAPhil.com for more information. Stay tuned for the interviews. Mystic Pete here, December 5th, 2022. I'm with Stefan Haves and Phil Giffen. You are putting together a show called Shambles with the Actors Gang at the Ivy Substation in Culver City. That's December 8th through the 31st. Two extremely creative people. I'll let you introduce yourselves. Stefan.
Stefan Haves here.
How about if I introduce Stefan?
Okay, sounds good, Phil.
Stefan Haves, and in parentheses, Cirque du Soleil director, is one of the most creative people I know, and I've had the pleasure of knowing him and working with him for, I don't know, a long time. I would rather not say. But it was around the time they used to deliver big chunks of ice to everyone's house for the refrigerator. Was that about right? Anyway, it's been a long time. And anyway, he's an amazingly creative, hilarious person. And he's the director of this show called Shambles. I'm merely his music director. There you have it. Please meet Stefan Haves.
Thank you. I'm glad Phil brought up the ice because we lived in adjacent igloos in Alaska. So it was terrific. Those times were great. Thank you for bringing that up.
I need my drum set, man. I need to cue my drummer.
I know. We need the rim shot. And the only other caveat that I have is I have worked with Cirque du Soleil probably since 2000, not probably, really, since 2007. And I haven't not directed a Cirque du Soleil show, but I am known as a clown director, comic act designer, clown whisperer. I do master classes, and if they need any North American clowns, I'm one of their guys they go to.
It's described as an immersive Cirque-infused panto, as in pantomime, holiday heyday, and atomic joy.
That is correct, and that's a mouthful. Who would write that? Who wouldn't edit that? That would be me. But I want to say part of it is a panto is actually a traditional holiday run that's done in London where they play different parts and they can take something like Goldilocks, but they'll have someone like Britney Spears music and they'll have all kinds of current things and they wink to the audience. And so the panto is kind of what we're doing this holiday. The immersive part is the show does not start. You do not walk in, Mystic, and you do not walk in and sit in your seat. What you do is you actually are on another planet in the adjacent foyer where aliens sing a Christmas song, which was from a show I did 40 years ago at the Zephyr Theater called The Cardigan Christmas Show, in which we sang The Cardigan Christmas Show. So, aliens sing it. 40 years later, I'm having the Actors Gang Company sing The Cardigan Christmas Show, which is interrupted by a cat named Musk. And Musk stops them and says, hey, get into my rocket ship. So they all get into his rocket ship. The entire audience, it's kind of like Andy Kaufman taking people out for pizza way back in the day. They're going into a rocket ship through the briny deep, through a strobe light inner world to the Day of the Dead, upstairs to a 1962 house where a woman is getting ready for the NASA space party, and then you sit down.
I don't see how people cannot go after that description. Sounds extraordinary.
Yes, thank you.
It also says time travel, live band, bubbly treats.
That's true. We have free champagne. And we have, and Phil is definitely alive.
I'm the live part of the live entertainment. The band, they're made up of corpses, but we've had a lot of generous donors, so I'm very grateful to them. A lot of
grandparents. Something is happening here.
So you want to tell us a little bit about the band, Phil?
We have two out front singers. I shall name them Karen Blake and Valerie Pinkston. And then our guitarist, Jeff Paris, also sings. And we have a bass player named Jonathan Pentoff. We have a keyboard player named Chris Giardino. And then we have a drummer named Dan Patrucci. It's a killer, killer band. We play my arrangements. And I think there's one original song. One kind of interesting point is I composed a Christmas song for a TV movie last Christmas. I think it was Lifetime or something. I should know, but I don't. As long as the check's clear for the royalties, I'm fine. Anyway, this was a rare occasion where my kids wrote the lyrics, and my adult kids, and they're super creative, super talented. Neither are interested in music, which I don't think is such a bad idea to get a real job. But it was kind of cool to, this was their first experience getting royalties from this movie, you know, airs every year in 100 countries. So fortunately, I own all those rights. Therefore, we're putting it in Stefan's show. We're just playing unique arrangements of some songs you have heard, some that you haven't. And we have, should we talk about the mega mashup, or is that giving away too much?
I think one thing, you're burying the lead, Phil. I'm glad you talked about your Christmas show, but ultimately what's really fascinating about this grouping of songs is we actually did them 11 and 10 years ago in the Atomic Holiday Free Fall and Liftoff show, as well as Your Town Follies shows. which we did at the El Portal, Fay Dodeau, Cafe Largo. And so we have a new generation of 20-somethings doing it, and that's really kind of a fun thing that a lot of it is. We have one mashup, which how many songs do we do in 3 minutes?
It might be 23 songs, just like one after another in 3.5 minutes or something.
Starts and ends with I Love LA, goes through everything. We made love in my Chevy van, and that's okay with me. You light up my life. So it's actually at the end of the show, and it's a huge send up. So.
In fact, I will add that, you know, Stefan and I, we were talking about, you know, doing, inserting new material here and there. And then he played this stuff for his cast, and they insisted. They put ownership on it. They said, no.
Yeah,
we want this.
I was like, shouldn't we do something more current? They're going to be bored. But the second they heard some of these things, they're just like all over it. It was great. It was amazing.
Well, in Los Angeles, we have all kinds of productions happening. And there's the kind of official legit stuff. But then we get these creative, extraordinary occurrences once in a while. And sometimes they end up inspiring a lot of people, and just new ideas, new ways to think, new ways to act, be on stage and experience entertainment.
Well, that's what I really saw this as, is this is kind of a after the plague, there's always a renaissance, and the artists are the ones that go out first, and the clowns are the ones that can help people to forget and to actually land in the here and now and actually have a total celebration in community. So that's what we're doing here. And we're doing Cirque du Soleil in a postage stamp, basically. We've got kabuki drops of curtains. We've got a huge boat. We've got NASA space gizmos. We've got a 17-foot rocket ship that you see that is made out of scaffolding. So it's the most stupidly ambitious thing that I've done, I think. And the Actors Gang has been completely supportive for such whimsy. And I can tell you, Tim Robbins, before I did this, I did an intensive for 30 hours. I did a clown intensive with his company. So when we went into rehearsal, they were so ready to do it. And Tim was totally supportive to me and my this kind of weird aesthetic, because clowns have a bad rap. So yeah.
Tim has been super supportive musically as well. And just Tim's brother, Dave, composer, film composer, guitarist, is supervising our sound. And he's doing a great job as well.
Tim is quite a visionary. And we want new things. We want something different. We tend to gravitate towards things we know, but particularly in this time when half of the world is kind of bunkering down into defensiveness and intolerance and hate and just like being mean, like the other side has to have a vision, has to define something new, has to excite people. And I think we need to be bold, particularly with our art creating.
Well, bold is how I would describe Stefan, and this is not no one could guess what this show would be like. It's a surprise to me, frankly.
The other thing that I can honestly say is the beautiful thing about clowning and circus is it's redefined by the generation or by who you're working with. So in this particular iteration called Shambles, it's all the men play madmen wives and all the women play NASA scientists. So I'm doing a gender fluid, very inclusive show and family friendly. So it is not gratuitous. It is fun. It is closer to Benny Hill and Mel Brooks than it is to me trying to, as an adolescent, try to push boundaries. It's really about sharing with people.
Well, I think it is important that the gender fluid community isn't simply defensive in these times, but actually defines new visions and makes it accessible and shows people how fun and friendly and innocent and holistic and sweet it is, the whole concept of a new, more open sexuality.
Amen to that.
Yes, and you know, the child is asleep in some of us, alive, but asleep, you know? So we want to wake them up. And you as a kid dressed up. There was a dress-up corner when you were in nursery school. You dressed up without judgment, without shame. And a lot of the clown work is prepubescent. It has to do with, we were all perfect clowns before puberty.
Now, Stefan, you have quite a background. Cirque du Soleil, Stefinity Entertainment, National University of Theater and Cinema Arts, CalArts, Pasadena Playhouse, Dream Canteen in China, Tisch School of Arts, Teatro Zenzani, that's up in the Bay Area, Cal State University. Wow. And that's just some of them. Yeah.
And thank you for letting me do a shameless plug right now, because I'm going to be rolling out a manuscript called The Power of Ha. And that's going to be December 15th, and we're going to do a signing, book signing at the show. And it's, you know, part memoir, part, you know, hero. I look at the heroes throughout my life, and that could be a guy I saw on the streets of Paris in 1984, who then won a Tony on Broadway, David Shiner, and then brought me to help him with Full Moon, and then went on to do Cuza with him. So dropping out from an MFA program at Brandeis University was the most shame-based moment of my life, which actually drew me to what I truly wanted to do, which was find out what physical theater and comedy is all about.
And you have a very unique way of working with actors. What locks, what blocks, and what unlocks? Talk about that a little bit.
There are no good or bad actors. If we were all perfect actors or clowns before puberty, then we have to, I'm not here to teach you anything, Peter. I'm here to remind you. You're here to remember. And so if I can open the door to your memory of when you were with one friend and you had no shame and total confidence, then that's the best you. So I have to break it down into a diagnostic, which is, when I look at you, body, voice, speech, and imagination. Those are the four things. And now, what blocks those things? Adrenaline. I'm addicted to adrenaline because I love being on the spot, but adrenaline can make me a horrible actor because it's playing, as this would be for Phil, my piano's playing me, I'm not playing my piano. So that's how you learn technique. And so technique in how you present yourself publicly, you've got to, adrenaline becomes your friend. Adrenaline becomes something that you know how to manage. So what do you do about that adrenaline? Well, that's what I do with clown work. And it was acting work for 20 years, and then it became clown work for 20 years. But Phil can address this when he works with singers or probably recording artists that come in, because you got studio musicians coming in all the time. How do you do it?
I think what you're touching on is everybody performs better when they're comfortable and when they're not riddled with self-doubt and fear. So it's I'm a composer, but I'm also a record producer. And part of a record producer's job is to kind of make everyone feel like they're $1 million, because really you're going to get the best out of them when they feel like it's okay to take a risk. And I swear 90% of the risks that are taken, at least in my world of making records, 90% of the time they pay off. It's like, that's the hook.
And that's what you do when you're relaxed.
Correct. So. And you're just like, it came from wherever, whether it's your fingers or your throat. It all begins in the mind, of course. But, you know, when you break down the walls and just let that flow, that thing flow, almost like you're not really thinking too hard about it. And that's when you mine the gold.
Well, Stefan and Phil, you've come from this Zen place, and let some extraordinary work emerge. The show is called Shambles. It's with the Actors Gang, And people could see it starting December 8th through the 31st, 12 shows, I believe, at the Ivy Substation in Culver City, stephanhaves.com. Phil, what's your website?
PhilipGiffen.com.
ActorsGang.com. I think we have all the information there. Any last words, guys?
Well, thanks for your interest.
Yeah, and it's nice talking about what we do. And I think the big deal for me is just how do we get people to look at theater differently? So theater isn't something that you watch and isn't a passive art form, but it becomes active. It's not linear, it's holographic. So then people have to figure stuff out, and it's way more fun. They do it on their phone all the time, but how do we trip the light fantastic when they go into a proscenium house? How do you stage it so they're going, I don't know what's next, but this is awesome. So that's what we're trying for.
Stephan Haves, Phil Giffen, thank you so much for your time. I'll see you soon.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
That blondie I bumped into when I come in here. Looked like she had a couple of dollars.
Yeah, she works for Oliver Warbucks.
The Oliver Warbucks? The millionaire?
Nah, the billionaire, you dumb
hotel. You know, she works for him in his mansion up on Fifth Avenue.
Fifth Avenue?
He don't live on Fifth Avenue.
He don't? Where's he live?
Oh, yeah.
Easy Street. Easy Street, where the rich folk play,
where they play
all day.
What that dame want?
Oh, brought me the wonderful news that Annie, one of the orphans from here, is getting adopted by Warbucks. Gonna have everything. The rotten kid is gonna have everything.
Crummy orphan living in a lap of luxury. It ain't fair.
Nah, it ain't fair.
It ain't fair how we scrounge for $3 or $4 while she gets Warbucks.
The little brat.
It ain't fair! This life is driving me nuts! While we get peanuts, she's living fat.
Maybe she holds the key, that little lady.
What, to get more bucks?
Yeah, instead of less.
What?
Maybe we fix the game with something shady.
Where does that put us?
Oh, tell her.
Give you one guess.
Yes, 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 yes!
Easy Street. Easy Street. Annie is the king. Yes, sorry, yes, sorry, yes, sorry, yes!
It's November 29th, 2022. Mystic Pete here with Michelle Danner,
who's a well-known acting teacher and director, and you have a school that we are currently in. So you, the listeners may hear some voices in the background of actors rehearsing.
Exactly. They're rehearsing in one room. They're having scene study in another room.
We're here doing it. Hi.
Hi.
Tell me a little about your background, then we'll get into more about your work.
Well, it all started on a stormy night. No, I'm just kidding. I was born in New York. My dad was the president of the William Morris Agency in Paris. He opened the very, very first offices of the William Morris. And so I grew up playing under his desk, you know, listening to conversations, great stars coming into his office, talking about their careers, talking about their dreams. And
epic. What a way to grow up. Would you drop some names just so we could get that out of the way?
You know, Edith Piaf, Sammy Davis Jr., Charles Aznavour, Benny Goodman. There was a slew of great performers. And so I grew up in Europe. I traveled all over Europe, and I developed an appreciation for literature, for theater, for art. I loved anything that was theater. I loved to go to the theater. I started to go to the movies where I was very young. And then we moved back to the States. We moved back to New York, where I was lucky enough to study with Stella Adler and with Uta Hagen and some other wonderful teachers.
So these are famous acting teachers. If you're not in the field, you may not have heard of them.
Famous, iconic acting teachers. And then I moved to L.A., in about 30 years ago, and started to teach myself, and it changed my life. So I was always very creative. I was passionate about acting. As a matter of fact, I teach this class, and I start the class by posing those three questions. What is great acting? What is a great actor? And what's a great acting moment? So, and I think the answer to that can be quite complex and requires, you know, serious conversation. And so I'm always prepared to have it because it's a fun conversation to have.
Well, tell me about the journey of emerging actors and how are people learning this? It's a craft.
It's a craft. I mean, people think that it's something that you can just whip up. But the truth of the matter is that it's a craft that you have to learn, and maybe come to the conclusion that you can never quite master, but something to aspire to, something to keep raising the bar. There's a technique to learn. Throughout the years, people have heard techniques, you know, when it comes to acting, such as the Meisner technique or Stella Adler's technique or Stanislavski's technique. And those are all great techniques to understand, to study, to experiment with. You know, ultimately, even though there's a craft to learn, it all leads you to fun because acting is fun. There's no
fun.
It's fun. There's no other way to look at it.
So you have to be playing on stage. There has to be a sense of creativity and enjoyment for it to really have power.
Absolutely. I think, well, you know, listen, I think somebody could be very stressed out and in turmoil and distraught, and they could still have power. But for the health of the artist, the best thing is to be able to just get out of your head and have fun, because then if you have fun, it's contagious and the audience has fun.
So let's talk a little about some of the details here. Somebody comes in. So they have some kind of dream of stardom, of being on stage. They want to be a celebrity, or they're just charismatic people. They're, when they walk into a room, everybody pays attention to them. They know it, and everybody's always said, oh, you should be an actor. So they start with this idea. What do we do from there to turn them into Robert De Niro?
Well, first of all, they have to want to be, you know, they have to have a desire to want to create. And if they do, that's a good start. If somebody is
passion.
Yes, that's a very good start. You know, you can't teach someone passion. You can't teach someone drive. You either have it or you don't have it. But But there's something absolutely wonderful to acquire because, you know, knowledge is power. And so when you realize what there is to learn, some people don't know what there is to learn, but when you really come to the realization that you have to learn certain things, it gives you a certain confidence. It gives you clarity. And that clarity, that confidence, makes you feel powerful.
Yes, they need to come with some passion and desire and probably a lot to see them through the rigorous task of rejection and, you know, going to auditions. What are the things you teach that really give them the mechanics?
The first thing is to be able to learn how to read a script, how to read a screenplay, how to read a play, how to understand who the character is, how to break it down. And there's a formula on how to break it down. You break it down into the event, what's going on in the scene, what's the relationship, those basic questions, what do you want, what's the obstacle, what's in the way. And although these are basic questions and seem simple in theory, in practice sometimes answering them, you know, takes time. You really have to think about it. I know that when I break down a script and do what is called an acting, the script analysis, and you start to go, well, you know, what does that person want? What do they really want? Because, you know, there's a conscious want and there's an unconscious want, and there's always, you know, an elephant in the scene, something that you don't talk about, which creates a subtext in the scene, which is interesting, and sometimes it's inspired by certain secrets that different characters have, what they don't say, what they want to do, what they don't do. All of that creates energy, it creates electricity. And so the dissection of that is, you know, a fascinating ride for any person that's really interested in digging deep and understanding what's really going on here.
So someone may be able to deliver lines, but they really have to understand what's behind it so it has meaning. And just like the subtle meanings, the hidden meanings, this is called script analysis. So
correct.
That's a place to start learning
correct.
How to act. You have to really get what's going on. I mean, we've all seen bad Shakespeare where they're spouting the lines or perhaps with some bad English accent, but they don't really know what's going on. They may not even understand the language.
That's right. To really understand, first of all, the language is really important. The tone. What is the tone of the piece? If it's stylized, it's somewhat stylized. It's not stylized at all. Very real. So it's all part of the process of digging deep for the actor.
All right. So there's one, understanding what you're doing. I mean, yeah, you're right. It sounds obvious. But there's probably a lot to stepping back and trying to discern underlying motivations.
Right.
What's really going on?
And all of those are called choices. The choices that the actor makes. And the degree to which you're interesting to watch as an actor is the degree to which you know how to make these choices.
We've all seen overacting too. And it may be somebody just trying to push through on the text, but somebody who really understands what's going on in the scene may be able to convey the same thing with much less drama, and it becomes a stronger performance.
You see a lot of acting and overacting in soap operas, for instance. You know, it's always the joke of the soap operas. You know, people are not connected. You overact when you're not connected to something that's going on inside of you.
I've often appreciated foreign movies, European movies, because the acting can be a little bit more subtle, more gentle. We're not trying to push people's faces into various emotions. It's just like, dignify the audience. Assume they have intelligence and they can understand what's going on, and you don't have to spell everything out so blatantly.
That's right.
Okay, understanding, and then let's go on from there. What else does one learn?
How to create a character that's different than you, how to inhabit the skin. What are the questions that you have to ask to believe, to immerse yourself in this person's life, in their spirit, take on their flame, to believe that you're that person with that set of circumstances that surround you, taking on a life. And that's something wonderful. That's where your imagination gets cooking. Because you imagine, what if? Those are the famous two magical words for actors. What if? What if I was this person? What if I lived here? What if I was married to this person and had these children, lived this life?
I know the difference when I'm just watching and there's no self-conscious, there's no self-consciousness, as opposed to watching and going, oh, I am watching a movie. Like, you're aware of these people acting, rather than you're just in the art.
Well, the moment that you're aware of people acting, then, you know, you're not, they're probably acting if you're aware of them acting.
Right, right.
Yeah. I think that you have to forget that, you know, there's that famous story. It was with Gregory Peck. A first AD found his script. And he said, oh, Mr. Peck, I found your script. And I noticed there were a lot of NARs on the left of the lines. What does NAR mean? This is a famous story. And he said, no acting required.
Mm.
And that was, I think, a great story for actors. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you can just say it because you believe it. Sometimes you have to conjure. Sometimes you have to substitute. It depends. Sometimes you just have to trust. You just have to trust that you believe in the person, in the life, in the circumstances, and just go. Let your stallion go.
Well, so it doesn't appear like it's put on or they are acting now. What else can people do to kind of lose themselves in the role? I know some of the acting techniques suggest you refer to an earlier situation in your life where you felt that same emotion. Or
concentration is a very big one. What Mr. Meisner taught all those years, which is put your attention on the other person. That's how you lose yourself. You have to be in the moment. Because even if you're 99% in the moment, and there's just one little percent that holds back, then you're not in the moment. Then that reads as being acting, not being real, not being truthful to the moment. So, you know, exercising your instrument to really put your attention, really get off of yourself, because when you get off of yourself, this is what the Meisner technique is about. You're not self-conscious. And that those are wonderful exercises that they have. It's not the whole bowl of wax. It's not the whole thing, but it's part of it. There's many, many different other, you know, tools that you have, but one of them certainly is to get off of you and put your attention onto the other person. The other thing is to understand the power of intention, which is, what are you doing to the other person moment to moment? You're attacking them, you're pleading, you're cajoling, you're nailing them with your truth, which I love that one. You know, you have to find those active phrases that make you want to get up, you, the actor playing that part, and do it. Something that fires you up. You've got to find those verbs. You've got to find those active, you know, sentences. I just was at the theater the other night at the Almondson, and I saw a play, 222 Ghost Story.
A little horror.
Did you
see it? Yeah, I've heard about it.
Oh, it's very good. It's the last week this week.
I've heard mixed reviews.
Yeah, you know, I really liked it. Hmm. I don't know. There's a couple of jarring screams all throughout. Maybe that's what perturbed people. But I thought, all in all, it was a solid piece of work, a very interesting acting. I love it when you walk out of a play and you think about it. And it sparks conversation. I think every place should do that. When you walk out of a musical or a play and you just go, oh, that was fine. That was fine. No, it should not be fine. You either should hate it, or you should love it, or you should start to really, you know, get into it. But I thought that was very interesting. Of course, you know, coming off of 2 years of not going to the theater, you know, I was lucky enough to see American Buffalo in New York, with Sam Rockwell and Larry Fishburne, directed by Neil Pepe, and then I saw Billy Crystal and Mr. Saturday Night. So, but all in all, it's been sparse because, you know, we're getting back. It's such a beautiful thing to go watch people do what you're asking me about, which is giving those performances that are so truthful, that you so believe it's that person. And when people are successful in doing that, audience can't separate the actor from the person, you know? They go up. I mean, Jason Alexander always told the story about how people wanted to go up and slap him from the movie Pretty Woman.
Oh, because people thought that was him.
That's right. They couldn't separate him, Jason, from the character he was playing and how he, you know, was brutal with Julia Roberts.
So I guess that's something actors like when people want to come up and slap him.
Well, probably not. Right. I'm assuming not. But, you know, yes, there is another way to look at it, which is to say it's a compliment.
He was convincing.
He was convincing. That's right. Yeah.
As a performer myself, one of the things I'm aware of, and I'm sure all actors are, you're playing with time. In other words, there has to be almost a suspension of time for it to be very successful. In other words, well, people lose track of time, and 2 hours may go by in a second, or a second may go by in 2 hours. Like, time becomes pliable, and somehow the actor's magnetism or presence or all the components of a production take people into this timeless place.
Absolutely. But I think if you are in the moment, if you really are not self-conscious, you lose track of time. You lose it. And it makes the audience just, you know, a play can go by really fast, or a movie can go by really fast, or it can be very painful, right, and laborious.
And you keep stopping to go get some popcorn.
If you don't lose yourself in the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little about some of the other mechanics of acting. So I have no problem myself with the presence and the, like, showing up on stage and doing, but I've always had a problem with memorizing lines. Like, just getting words in my head and not worrying about it. And it seems like some people can just memorize a whole script overnight. But to me, it's just so difficult.
Well, you can't think about memorizing. You just have to take away the concept of memorizing. It's about understanding, it's breaking, doing the script analysis like I talked about, understanding who the character is, answering the questions, building the life. And then when you have that, you take the words, you take the literature, you say it over and over again with intent. You say it with intent, with different intentions. You play with it, you get up on your feet, you physicalize it. That's a big thing, to put it through the words through your body, let them wash over you, see what it does to you physically. And then you start to own it, because then what happens is the body has muscle memory, the body remembers. So the words, at one point, it'll come instinctively. You won't think about the words. So it's not about sitting there and saying, you know, I really want you to understand that I will not tolerate this anymore. You know, you play around with that, and you play around with the next sentence and the sentence that precedes it, and you physicalize it. And then you do that day after day, and one day you will find that all of a sudden you just know it. It's miraculous. You didn't have to struggle through any process of memorizing. But another great tool that I find is when you're doing a scene with someone else, you record their line and you leave a space for your dialogue. And you rehearse it like that. You know, you hear their line, then you do your line. And so that's another way that can help you to retain it.
Instead of trying to drill it into your head,
yeah,
let it come naturally.
Yeah, you don't want to say, I will not tolerate this a second longer. I will not tolerate this a second longer. I will not tolerate. No, so you don't do it like that. You know, you just, you don't worry about memorizing whatsoever. There's so much joy in creating. And if you're a person that is creative, whether you're a writer, you're a director, you're an actor, and you just have to create, it's just something that you have to do with your life, then you have to, even though, you know, you may have a family and you may juggle work or whatever is going on in your life, you have to make time for that, because that is sacred time. And that ultimately will speak to your soul.
And tell us about some of these projects you've worked on.
Well, I have several movies that are out. Bad Impulse, The Runner. I just finished working on Miranda's Victim, which is about the Miranda rights, how they came about. Mm. I mean, I remember even my last movie, The Runner, I had a whole scene where you have the right to remain silent, and if not, no. And I never questioned, where did that come from? What led to that? What led to the Miranda rights? So we're telling the story of the person that this happened to. And it's a great courtroom thriller. And it has some wonderful actors in it. Abigail Breslin from Little Miss Sunshine. Well, she's all grown up now, and she's fabulous. And Donald Sutherland, which has always been a hero of mine, and Andy Garcia and Kyle MacLachlan are in it. Ryan Felipe, Luke Wilson, Taryn Manning, Emily Van Camp, Josh Bowman. Nolan Gold, I've mentioned him from Modern Family. There's just, I just got so lucky. Dan Loria, if you know him.
Yeah, must be a pleasure working with these top people.
I really.
You just get out of the way and let it happen, I mean, right? Yes. When people are so good.
They were just so good. I mean, so good. And then the acting is like, I was sitting there and it was a master class in acting, every scene. It was fabulous, and I had the best time shooting this on the East Coast. And now I'm knee-deep in post-production, which I love. But I'm teaching this weekend. I'm teaching the Golden Box class, which is about a lot of what we've talked about, a lot of these tools that actors have to have at their fingertips to create something that is exciting and unique, which is very much what we're all after, whether it's from the writing point of view or directing or acting. You're all looking to watch something that is unique and that's going to hold your attention. And ultimately, I believe very much has to move you. Of course, moving you is subjective. What moves you might not necessarily move me, but there is also universality to us all as an audience, and that's why 2,000 people can sit in a Broadway house and watch Death of a Salesman that's getting a revival and weep.
Yes.
Because there's something universal about great writing, and we're all are so much more alike than not.
Well, we look to artists to express things that perhaps we have a hard time feeling. They're feeling helping us to feel sadness or joy or anger, and all this stuff is perhaps shoved down all the time, and in a dark box or an opera, or we can let it out and feel better, feel human.
Absolutely. Stories, the performers, they hold a mirror up to us that have to do with, you know, what it feels like to be human, what it feels like to survive, what it feels like to love. And that's right. I mean, I think that a piece of theater or a movie or a TV show does its job if after you see it, it does something to you and it makes you want to, in turn, go reach out to someone.
So let's now talk about the journey of the artist getting work, getting paid, or even just getting on stage, because I know, as an artist myself, like, we need to perform regularly just to feel alive, to feel human, if that's the way we're built. And it's almost it's a cliche. It's unfortunately a reality of the artist waiter. You know, so many people come to Los Angeles and they think they're going to be famous. They got to take a second, third job, and years later, I don't know, once in a while it happens, but that's rough. It's really rough on us to face so much rejection, to face so many calls, to keep our spirits up when we go for these auditions and so forth. So let's talk about that and how you coach people through this. I joke that, you know, they could train people here in LA as an actor before they send them off to war in Iraq because they're going to be so tough afterwards.
Well, you know, rejection is part of every, you know, métier in life, right? And hearing the word no. But you know, just like in life, you have to put it out there. You have to put it out there and just keep getting, you know, back on the horse or the bicycle or whatever you want to call it. And just keep doing it. So I had a wonderful call. I don't know if I can say it, but I'll say it. Ridley Scott called me a couple of months ago. Ridley Scott called me a couple of months ago and he said, I saw your movie, The Runner. I was very impressed. And he went on and on and on. But that's not what I retained from it. It was certainly very nice to hear that Ridley Scott loved my work. I was, you know, certainly very happy. But what he said at the end is the key is to keep doing it. And so he, you know, does one project after the next. And, you know, as you, when you create, nobody has you know, nobody has the thing where everything is perfect except for Meryl Streep. She's the only one. But other than that, people, you know, hit, you know, the valleys and you peak and you go down and you go up and it's the roller coaster. And some people say no, some people say yes, more people say no than yes. Some people don't like your work, some people do. You just have to stay true to yourself. You have to, you know, have integrity in terms of your work, and you just have to keep doing it. You have to put one foot in front of the other and just wake up every day and say, what am I going to accomplish creatively today? What am I going to do? And no matter what, you know, yes, it's nice when people validate you and they say yes to you and they hire you and you get work, of course, that's just great. And then when you get work, it's great if you get great reviews and if you get awards, and all that works really well. It's certainly less painful than if you fall on your face and people don't like what you do and people, you know, decimate you. And but you have to be able to tolerate both. And it's almost, I know it's hard to understand or believe, but they both are the same on a certain level, you know. You never can go so high up and you're being so ecstatic with yourself that, oh my God, they loved me, or all the way down because they thought I was a piece of none of it is really, really true anyway.
Well, there is something about being paid. You just created something, a piece of art, music, on stage, and here is money, because what you did has like this kind of value in the real world. There's something about being paid as an artist that really, I don't know, it's just so important. And without that, we still need to do art. But that actual exchange really, it does something.
It does something, but I think that if you're willing to do it and not get paid for it and do it only because you love it, I think that has a lot of value too. I think the money that you get for doing something that you love is icing on the cake. But if you're willing to do it because you love it that much, and there's been countless stories of actors that have signed on to projects and contributed to them and deferred their payment because they believed in what it was about, the story, the character, whatever it said.
But I think a part of it is in our hands. In other words, if the world is ignoring us or not giving us the kind of recognition we want, well, we have to dig deeper. We have to get better. Like, we have to go and find our muse. When that gets so strong, the world can't ignore us anymore. So, like, there is this individual part, rather than showing up, oh, I want to be a celebrity, I want to be famous, like getting enchanted by people loving you, rather than, well, you as an artist. I don't think that's a strong enough motivation to get you through the challenges of being an artist. In other words, like, just the desire for fame, you won't survive. You have to do this.
No, it's wanting, like what you said, you wanting your voice to be heard.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Right.
And that's stronger than anything.
That will see you through all the challenges and rejections and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about this lovely school you have.
Yes, we are here in Culver City at Los Angeles Acting Conservatory, the Michelle Denner Acting Studio. And this brings together a lot of people that want to create. I mean, I remember when I took acting classes way back then, I still have those relationships that I made are people that I collaborate with today. My producers are people that I met in acting class. So you really forge lifelong relationships. That's why. And it's fun. It's fun to act. And so we have lots of students that come from here, from, you know, L.A., Hollywood, and come from different parts of the world, because people know that Hollywood holds a special energy. When you want to act, you want to come here, you want to find a way to be creative. At every corner, somebody's talking about making a movie or writing something, and this is where you want to be, and you want to create a community around you, which now more than ever, I mean, we realize the importance of that, because with COVID, it was taken away from us. We were all in our apartments and our homes, and, you know, we missed being together. We missed going to the theater. We missed rehearsing a scene, taking an acting class. And just now, you've started to be able to do it without masks. And, you know, come what may, you know, if you're protected, if you're vaccinated, if you're boosted or whatever, if you're, you know, people now understand this virus that we're dealing with. And hopefully with this, you know, even though there's talk still about it, you know, putting it behind you so that we can come back and be together, because that we crave that as artists.
Any words about approaches you take that either your students like or that produce good results, whether it's on one end, you know, the severe, harsh approach, or the other end, praising everything and coddling them? What unlocks the...
Well, I think there's the in-between. I think that, you know, I studied with teachers like Stella. She was rough on people and berated people. But also, you know, wonderfully enlightening. I mean, she gave us gold. You know, Sandy Meisner would go up and pinch students. and so, you know, a lot of the Meisner teachers, you know, teach, and a lot of teachers teach acting with a certain whip. And some students, listen, may need that, may benefit from that. Other people, like you said, praise. You know, I believe in telling people the truth. You know, there's a great line in a David Mamet play that said, "I'm going to give you the courtesy of telling you the truth." I'm paraphrasing. I think the truth is, you know, so the truth has both. You know, the truth has, you know, yet sometimes you have to kick people for them to wake up and tell them what they're doing that is good. Because a lot of times people come into this business, you know, they're broken, they're misunderstood. And it doesn't help if, you know, you put them to the floor and they have to work at getting themselves up. You want to give them tools to be better, to understand, you know, how to be creative. So I teach more. My style is more nurturing. My style on set as a director is very calm. I'm very, very calm. I don't feel like I have to yell, you know, it's the cliche of yelling to get what you want, because I always get what I want, and I never have to yell. So I'm always very, you know, soft-spoken. A couple of times, you know, I've had to raise my voice a couple of times, but not too often.
What's your website?
My website is michelledanner.com, Los Angeles Acting Conservatory.com.
MichelleDanner.com, MichelleDanner. Michelle Danner, thank you for your insights and your time.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles, you can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. My interview with Stefan Haves and Phil Giffen started the show, then a tune from Annie called Easy Street, and I just concluded the interview with Michelle Danner. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!